Oh, hey, it's me, the girl that has the podcast, and I'm unsure how to open the podcast today, so this is what we ended up with. Let's roll the intro. Oh, hey, fancy seeing you here. Welcome to the podcast. My name's Naomi. I'm your host, and this is Mindful Musings. A place where you get to learn all about fitness, nutrition, psychology, and how they're all deeply interconnected. Sometimes we take a tangent or two, but in the end, I thank you for joining me, thriving with me, and growing with me. Now, let's go learn something together, shall we? What's up, everybody? It's me, your host, Naomi. I'm tired today, but it's, well, I am not that tired. It's raining here, so it's like, you know, cozy vibes. So far, just a side note, I'm liking spring more than winter because it's acting like winter. You know, you feel me? All right. That's a side tangent already. We're already entering a side tangent. I love winter, and I find it really interesting that, like, I don't know what I'm trying to say here exactly, but I just listened to a Tony Robbins podcast. That's a lie. It was a Theo Von podcast with Tony Robbins on it. And every time I listen to Tony Robbins, one, I'm always like, yeah, you're the man. I'm sorry if it's cheesier. I love him. Who doesn't, though? You know, that's why he's such a big deal. But, you know, he's talking about what we would call in my neck of the woods, like, these cognitive reframes, right? It's like what you focus on and what you think is what you think, if that makes any sense. So if you think in this positive light, you're going to have this positive outlook in life. And I think this is kind of how I've piloted my life. And so when I think about winter, as this relates, this is related, believe it or not. I think a lot of people think winter is like cold and dark and tired and it's hard and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no. Winter is a monochromatic, snowy white wonderland where things are quiet and soft and calm and beautiful. It's a time to turn inward. Introvert is in the room. That's me. It's a time to, like, it's just less bright and less harsh and less, like, like grindy than the bright HD colors of spring and summer and, you know what I mean? Like, I appreciate that, but there's something about winter for me that, like, brings this calmness, which is relevant to today's episode, that is so stinking soothing to me. And I think it possibly is because my ability to cognitively reframe that I really, really enjoy it. I don't see it as, you know, those negative things. It's these positive, wonderful things. And don't get it twisted. Storms come. Sometimes she's violent, right? But who's not? Okay, in today's episode, we are talking about something that, I don't know why this never occurred to me. I know why this never occurred to me. I'm going to talk about myself, which is incredibly uncomfortable for me. But what I do know about other human beings is that we are social beings and social creatures, and I'm one of them. And I like to hear other people's stories. It makes me feel seen and heard and connected. And so that is my hope for today. You know, if this is you, if you've ever shared a part of my story and you can kind of feel into that space, you know, I empathize with you. I'm here for you. I'm here with you. I think if more people talk about their journey in life in this world is, you know, hyper connected and not connected all at the same time. And I think that humans are a storytelling culture and being, and that's how we feel connected. And I think the evolution of what that looks like might kind of look like this. I think it's why people like podcasts. I think it's because it feels like you're talking to a friend. I think it's because it feels connected. It feels close. Is it? Yeah, I think I could make an argument for that. I'm not sure. That's not the point of today's episode. I made notes. I made notes. I don't make notes ever. I never make notes for the pod. Never do I ever. But I made notes. Because I think talking about myself feels... it's incredibly uncomfortable just because of my personality, like landscape, the way that I function and the way that I orient, to be vulnerable and share about myself. But I'm going to do that because, you know, I can do hard things and it really isn't that hard. I think that it's to the benefit of the whole, and I believe in that. So, you know, I practice what you preach, man. Okay. It's really hard for me not to make a Freud joke right here, but I'm not going to make the Freud joke because no one will get it. Okay. So I'm going to start with my childhood. Yeah, man, my parents got a divorce when I was young, and I had this complex thing go on that I'm not even going to really get into about like the paternity of my, you know, like who my dad is and this belief. And it's kind of hard. I think it's hard and it's not hard to explain that, but I don't want to share that with the podcast. I just don't. But what is relevant here is that I really wanted to make my dad happy, and he was a pretty stern guy. He, you know, he's a high achieving guy. He's, you know, the German blood is in there, which I'll get to a little more later. I was born to, you know, Japanese American mother and, you know, a Euro mutt, mostly German American father. His mother was, to my understanding, a stern, strong German woman who farmed. And she was raised, you know, in a family of men who were very similar. She married a man that was not that way. And so she was kind of the, maybe like the matriarch. She held a lot of the masculine energy. But the work ethic is the important piece there. To work in my family culture is to have meaning. And it is to be loved. And I use the word love often as kind of like this fundamental human, I'm going to go infantile need, right? It's like, love me, see me. My mother was raised to two, you know, she's a middle child. She's got a younger brother and an older sister. My dad has a younger brother who's more like his father, and my father is more like his mother. All of this to say that, you know, my mother was born to a citrus farmer. Her dad, you know, I only met my grandpa a few times, and I maybe heard him say two words my whole life. She loves him though. She loved him a lot. And speaks very highly of him. And I, you know, I could get into kind of my beliefs about family and cognitive distortions, but I'm not going to. I will, you know, maybe talk about that at a later date. But alas, they met, some stuff went on. You know, my sister was born 9.5 years before me, too. She had a different father than me, but that's my sister. And I have a brother as well, different mom than me, but that's my brother. And my brother comes from my dad, and my sister comes from my mom. So I was born, I am the youngest of, I guess, three. I kind of had a somewhat only child experience in some ways. In other ways, I very much had like the youngest child experience. I grew up in a home with my sister until she was 18 and I was 8. She moved out, and then it was, you know, only child party, sort of. Yeah, I was born into a family of high-achieving people. You know, my mother's father was a citrus farmer. You know, he worked really hard. We're Japanese, for heaven's sakes, if you don't know anything about the culture. I think right now the culture is really popular in American Western culture. But, you know, Japanese culture is, it's it's a force to be reckoned with. They're really big and brutal, like on sort of shame and punishment. It's brutal. It can be really culturally brutal, and you truly don't want to, you know, do this thing, which is like, quote, bring shame to your family. You really don't want to do that. And you get a lot of merit through work and intelligence. And I was born into a family of, you know, just really, they're sensory people and they're thinking people. And I mean that in the function sense. So I believe that, you know, I'm a highly sensitive person. I think my mother is. I wouldn't be surprised if my father was. Highly sensitive person is defined as a neurodivergent individual who is thought to have an increased or deeper central nervous system sensitivity to physical, emotional, or social stimuli. Some refer to this as having sensory processing sensitivity, or SPS for short. So, you know, a lot of people have this experience. I think that, you know, there's been books written on it, but I think it's important because it's touching on this nervous system sensitivity piece. And so I think some of us are highly tuned with really, 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 you know, finely tuned sort of outward facing sensory processes that pick up on every little energetic thing. And, you know, also these physical, like sight, sound. When I was a kid, I was always covering my ears. Everything was too loud. It's too loud. It's too loud. It's too loud. Everything was too bright. I was always turning off the lights. It's weird to kind of see as I've grown how that has affected me and like how I've kind of adapted in ways in which I kind of haven't adapted, which is interesting. But I, you know, I think this is all to say that I have like these finely tuned, like many people, kind of ways of picking up data from the external world, right? Whether it's energetic data, how other people feel, how bright it is, how loud it is, you know, the movements. I remember like being on our ski boat when I was a kid, and my dad, you know, he liked to go fast in the boat, and oh my God, I've never, like, I was so scared. And like my terror and fright, like it was too fast, it was too bumpy, it was too loud, it was so bright. Like I always, we were a boating family growing up. My family makes fun of me, especially my sister, because I used to go on these boating trips. Like they would be like a week long, and I would wear like this huge hat and cover my whole body with like all these towels, and like I was hiding from the sun. It was too dang bright for me. Like it just is too much. So, and like the sensory feeling of like the sun on your skin, like that intensely all day, was like too much for me. Just as a side note. Anyways, so in it, back to this intuitive and sensory piece, like I was a really sensitive kid. I'm a really sensitive adult. I think I spent like a pretty large chunk of my life up until now believing that like I'm not sensitive and I'm tough, and like I'm not. I'm really hardy. I have a lot of grit, but I'm really sensitive. I'm not tough. My toughness is, you know, people would call it tough, but it's not toughness. I get battered and bruised a lot. I just have a really good ability to like nurse my wounds and not show that it's hurting me, or not show that anything's been going on. Like it's, you know, it's like if you're an NFL player and you know, you have a high ankle sprain, you're wrapping, you're taping her up, and you're playing. And when you play, nobody knows, but it hurts. You know it, and you get used to tuning it out. You know, it's a socially rewarding skill, but it doesn't mean that, I don't know, when I think of tough, I think of like this really hard exterior that nothing gets into. And I don't know if anybody's really that tough. Maybe some people. Oh, the cat has brought me, please enjoy this break, brought to you. Mr. Peach likes to bring me this little toy. We call it Lizzie. But he brings me Lizzie in his mouth like a dog, and sets it beside me when he wants to play. So he wants to play, but I'm recording a podcast, so I can't play. Okay, back to the show. Okay. So these functions. So I was a highly sensitive person in my family. I think there's other highly sensitive people in my family. My mother specifically, I think she knows this really well. I, like I said, I wouldn't be surprised if my father was either. I actually wouldn't be surprised if he wasn't either, which is, that's interesting. Anyways, okay. But as far as function, I've never, like, I don't think I have. I have protected an area of my own psyche and a value of mine, because it had to do with me, but this episode's about me, so I will tell you what this is. And so this is about the Myers-Briggs type indicator. I don't know why I haven't talked about it. I think a part of it feels sensitive for me. It's an understanding that I have of the world. It's not the be all end all of everything. I've described it like a transparency that you can kind of place over, like quite literally, you know, transparent paper, and you have like an outline on it or something. And then, you know, you place another on top and you can see what's behind, but it doesn't necessarily dictate the new piece of paper on top or underneath. So it's kind of like that. It's like this framework that we all have, and there's 16 of them. 16 personalities is probably the testing that you've run into if you've ever Googled it. But that's a big five. It's really well adapted. I think it most often gives you a pretty good MBTI result. But the MBTI really is rooted in the Jungian idea of function. So it's like you're always seeking balance from Jung's point of view. And so no matter, you know, what you believe, and I'm not going to explain the whole theory, but I like this theory. It helps me understand kind of the constellations of different people to interface with them and have better empathy, which sounds super robotic, but I assure you it is not robotic at all. It's very natural for me. And this gave me languaging for what I've always done. And that was helpful for me. So I am a lead intuitive, which Jung described as perception via the unconscious. So this is a function that's as it's aptly named, it's intuitive. It strings together things. It's very seeking. It's very hungry, at least in me. It's always hungry for something. And it happens without me noticing. It's just how I function. You can hear it when I speak. It's how I string together all these weird things that don't feel strung together. You probably don't like my podcast if you're a sensor. If you're a sensor, you're probably like a storytelling podcast, like people who get on and they just chat with each other. That's not me. So I was born to family of like lead sensors or sensor dominant people, which Jung describes as a psychological function that transmits a physical stimulus to perception. So sensors are like, the world exists in the here, like it's here, the table's real. Like for me as an intuitive, like I'm like, is the table real? Like it's composed of atoms. Like, I don't know, are the atoms real? Like that's our understanding of the universe. Like, is it actually solid, or could we actually move through it if we understood the world differently? Like that's the difference. Sensors like, that's a table. And an intuitive is like, I'm going to think about a thousand ways in which that's a table and which it's not as well. Anyways, so that's a hard thing when you're a kid to kind of reconcile your understanding of the world with a bunch of people who can't mirror that back to you and can't affirm that for you. And you feel like a freaking alien. You really do. Especially because if you're a lead introverted intuitive, you already feel that way. It's very strange to have a body just the way that, you know, your brain functions. And this will be relevant later, but you know, I was highly sensitive, and then I was intuitive. So I was often really misunderstood in my family, and it wasn't for lack of care or love. It was just like, that's not what they had. I was like creating new buckets and filling them, and like they were like, what is this? Those are pieces of me. So I think some people maybe describe this as black sheep of their family. That's not really it for me. I never felt like an outsider in my family. I just felt completely like none of these people get it. Nobody gets me. For a long time, I didn't believe that anybody would until high school. And then, my entire friend group was all lead intuitives, and boy, was that affirming for me. And really, I'm really thankful for that period of my life. Another piece of my childhood that's important, I think there's a cultural piece, a family cultural piece, but I just wanted to be a good little girl to get love. I wanted to work hard and be good. So the better I could be, the better my grades could be, the harder I could work, you know, the more I could kind of prove or show that I was worthy of love, that's kind of what my being began to constellate around. Because it's a trade. I could trade it. Look at my good grades. Is that good enough? I think a lot of people, you know, in my experience, being human, interacting with other humans, I think that humans have this way of, we have like these begging questions that we kind of constellate around when we're children. And for a lot of people, myself included, it's, am I good enough? Am I good enough? Am I good enough? Have I done enough? And for me, that was very much rooted in like, because nobody could authentically see me and mirror that back to me, because I was born into a family that was very different than me, you know, I needed to find something that the sensory people around me could see. And so it was real tangible things. So I became, you know, hardworking, high achieving, you know, that got me somewhere. And boy, was I going to do it, because, you know, they say you're traumatized in just the right way. So I think that there's a few themes I've already touched on in my early childhood, but the further themes of my life that I feel are relevant is like, I spent a lot of my life really not being aware of my body or how I felt. I think that I had to learn really young to kind of shut off my own inner voice to fit into my family to receive love. At least that's the story that I received and the one that I kept telling myself unconsciously. I remember I started working out when I was 13 and my trainer at the time called me Bambi because I didn't know how to connect my body and my brain, which is hilarious because I later became I do that as a profession. And not only like training, I do like corrective exercise and like really have this intricate understanding of the body, but it did not start with me. It started with others, which is interesting. To me, this disconnection between mind and body has a lot to do with my nervous system. You know, if I'm highly prone or like highly sensitive to all these outside stimuli, I had to learn to kind of blunt that. And so I think, you know, I skipped blunting with covering my ears and I just was like, just turn it off. Just turn her off. And minds and brains are amazing. And I did that. So I developed this ability to block out pieces of my nervous system input. And a lot of us do this. I think that a lot of people, you know, use this as big T or little T trauma, you know, or it's like where we see that, boom, it's where we learn to turn off pieces of the nervous system. We have pieces of our childhood that are completely blacked out, pieces of experiences that are completely blacked out, emotions that are very difficult to tap into. That theme becomes important because I think it later manifests, well, as, you know, we call it the body's image, and in my world, image in the Jungian and the depth world is like, how is this manifesting? You know, how's it showing? So, if you're familiar with the body keeps the score, that's an example of body as image. The body says no, Gabor Mate's work, that's body as image. It's looking at the image or the imagery in front of you, the symbolism in front of you. And it's saying, you know, what's actually happening that isn't being expressed elsewhere. It will come out, right? But where will it come out? And so, oh boy, it comes out later, but I learned to turn that off. And all of that nervous system input wasn't off. It was being diverted into a different area that I was paying no attention to for a large portion of my life. And that starts to, you know, we can get into the science of how it starts to wear on the vagal nerve and how that becomes very difficult. But just know that your nervous system is so adaptable and so is your brain. And so I began to adapt to just ignore those pieces, which, you know, becomes a big problem because they're still happening. I just don't have awareness of them. So, you know, the heightened cortisol response, like the dysregulation inside the body, the disconnect from the self, like all of that becomes really important later, right? For my autoimmune disease. So after high school, you know, I got into working out. I really wanted to be a neurosurgeon. You know, I was told this story when I was younger and it has to do with like high achieving stuff, but I really wanted to be a therapist. And, you know, one of my sister's friends was graduating and she was going to school for psychology or something. And I remember my dad saying like, oh, only losers do that. And, I don't think he meant anything by it, but, well, other than that, like, a lot of people, you know, I think there's stigma around the mental health profession, and I think he was speaking to that stigma, and I heard that message loud and clear, you know? I heard it as, my daughter is not going to be a loser, and if she wants to be a therapist, she's a loser, and I wanted to make him proud, because I was still needing to exchange, you know, am I worthy, am I good enough for love, and so I blunted my own, you know, self inside, and I didn't dare speak that I wanted to be a therapist. And I thought, what else can I work with? I'm good at biology. I'll just work with the mechanical piece. I'll work with the brain. I'll be a neurologist. So, you know, I started going to school for bio and, you know, pre-med, and I was good at it, quite frankly. I was offered a position at a UCLA research lab. All I needed to do was apply, and I think I was having like this big, just like an existential crisis in some ways. Like I was like, is this ever going to end? Like, do I really want to do this? And my, I had a job at the time, down in LA. I would drive to down to Santa Monica Boulevard, and I was working at this pediatric dentist, and her husband was a neurosurgeon. And, you know, I talked to him and I shadowed him, and my old boss's husband was also one, and I just got all this information, and these people were miserable. They're miserable, and they had no time, and they had no life, and you know, I started projecting like I always do, but I was looking out in the future, and I thought, this isn't the life that I want. This, I knew it wasn't the life that I wanted, which at the time was driven by like this, it was a really unmetabolized kind of need, which is like, oh, like one day I'm going to have kids, and like, I'm going to be there for them, and I'm going to do all this, and da 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 da. You know, I just was trying to my mom worked a lot. You know, she was single. My parents divorced really young. She worked really hard. So she was around for me, but maybe not as much as I wanted her to be. And so I didn't want that for my kids. And at that time it was a really big driving fear of mine. And, you know, I wasn't very old, but I was like, oh, someday I'm going to have kids, and this isn't the life that I want. So I quit. I dropped it all. I then stumbled through a lot more school, 3 different majors at once, going to 3 different schools at once. I started a bikini company. The whole story is wild. I was doing a lot. I was a very highly functional, really workaholic person. I was getting things done. Well, I was getting things done. You know, I got really into fitness. And I think at first, working out became a place where I could connect to myself again. Like I could use my mind and connect to my body, and like mind-muscle connection, and like the science was interesting. And I've always really loved biology. I have a biological mind. It's like I was born with the, you know, the language already in me somehow. Probably the way my mom talked to me when I was a child. She's in the medical field, for those that don't know. And it's just really interesting, because that then became a place for me to really funnel into this disordered like punishment pattern, which is like, I'll become worthy. And like, I started to really kind of bastardize what working out was and what eating healthy was. I've always eaten healthy. I grew up eating healthy. My mom grew up on a citrus farm, you know, they didn't have a lot of money, so they ate a lot of vegetables. So she cooked like that for us. And I just, you know, it was, it's just a weird experience in that I was also dating someone who was a bodybuilder at that time. When I was getting into fitness, like everyone was going to go do a bikini competition. Disordered, like eating and orthorexia wasn't fully out there yet. I hired a bikini coach who was super disordered in her eating, which I didn't know at the time. I just thought this is how people were coached. And her coaching style with me was to be like crazy, crazy. I was assigned so much Stairmaster and restrictive eating and like monochromatic dieting, like all of the worst things. And, you know, I was going to be good at it. So I started doing it. And I remember Thanksgiving, it happened like a few weeks in, and she's like, you know, stick to your diet on Thanksgiving. And I remember thinking to myself, like, fuck that, man. I'm going to enjoy Thanksgiving. So I did. I just, which I think was the undisordered way of doing it. And I was like, la, la, la. Because it's like I was mimicking disordered patterns that weren't mine because they were like put into my coach. And the part where I was disordered was like, I'm trying to just make her happy and do a good job. And I remember she was so pissed at me that I had like eaten Thanksgiving, you know? And like as a nutrition coach now, I'm like, yeah, have Thanksgiving. Like it's not, yeah, that is irrelevant. Literally, you do not get the body you want or lose the body that you want or however your health in one meal or four meals or eight meals. Do you get what I'm saying? It's what you do consistently over a long period of time. Anyways, so I kind of learned to be disordered in my habits from somebody else, but it, you know, you mimic these patterns, you fake it till you make it, and then you make it. And so I started being really disordered, and I would think, oh, like if I ate something that wasn't on my diet, like I'm just gonna go, you know, on the Stairmaster more, and that becomes really disordered. And I remember like eating asparagus to drop water, like I would eat it raw, I would eat a whole bundle of it raw because I just want to get it down. And like that is crazy. It's crazy. I had leaky gut. I was eating a monochromatic diet. I ended up developing a food sensitivity to every single one of these foods I was eating because I was only eating seven of them. I would get incredibly bloated. Like this time was the lowest mental health point of my life because I was mimicking this really like mentally ill person that I didn't know at the time. I was really young. And I just remember like always looking at my body and being like, it's not working. And like, I look back now and I'm like, you looked great. Like you look good. And it's just so crazy to look back at that time in my life and how hard I was on myself. And you know, I really wanted to work hard. I really wanted to do a good job. And why that's important is because I was, you know, I was using a lot of stimulants, lots of caffeine. Remember Redline? I was drinking a lot of Redline, not good for your heart. I was working out like crazy 4 or 5 hours a day. I was doing 2-hour leg days 3-4 days a week. Like it was crazy. It was crazy. I was on the Stairmaster for a minimum of an hour a day. Like this is insanity. And it was, you know, looking back, but it wasn't intrinsically from me. I just wanted to do a good job for my coach. I wanted to do this thing right. And I to do that, you know, if you have that inner narrative to other always make other people happy so they love you, you really suppress your inner voice and you really get disconnected from yourself. And, you know, my journey of finding my way back to myself and connecting my mind to my body and finding like serenity and working out again has been really healing and really wonderful. But it's really interesting how dark it became. Sorry, the cat is bringing me the stuffed animal again. Okay. So I was running from how I felt. I didn't want to, you know, I was disconnected from how I felt. I didn't know that, you know, but like I said, all this stuff was just being funneled into a place that I was very unaware of. And here cues, and here comes the autoimmune problem, you know? It's like the physical symptoms begin to arise because the bucket starts to overflow. It was a slow overflowing. Like if I look back in high school, I remember being at urgent care for like something else, like a cold or something. And sometimes they like palpate your stomach or do, I don't remember why, but she was like pressing on my stomach and I was like, oh yeah, that's uncomfortable. And she goes, oh. And I go, oh, but it's always uncomfortable. And then she like gave me this weird look and I was like, is that not normal? Like I remember my boyfriend at the time would put his head on my stomach and I hated it because it like really hurt. It was really uncomfortable. I couldn't stand it. And I didn't even really want to lay on my stomach. And that was probably the first somatic symptom that I was like, oh, that's not normal. And I didn't know. And of course I didn't do anything, you know, a few years later, boy, would this come out. But like, and for that time I had no idea. I always used to say like, I wake up with sunshine shining out my butt. Like I just am a pretty happy person in general. But you know, there's a part of me that I was really disconnected from the angry, sad parts of myself. So of course I'm going to be happy. So, you know, cue my autoimmune disorder. I, you know, boy, I could go into the science part of this, but I guess I'll stay in the more, me parts. I woke up one day with like this really puffy face. I was always pushing on my face, like right under my eyes, like over my sinus cavity. I was like, I feel like my face is really puffy, and that's called moon face. Okay. It's a hormonal thing. I didn't know that at the time. I had gotten acne all over my face and I had gained weight. I went from a size like 0 to a size 6 in a month, which I was still a small person, but I was a really small person after high school. Not because I was trying to be, that was before my disordered eating. And I actually lifting weights made me gain weight and get bigger. But I was just a tiny person when I was younger, and then I was less tiny and I got more and more inflamed, and I just knew something was wrong with me. And I went to the doctor and it was like, oh, you have adult acne. And I was like, no, like, I weigh 20 pounds more than I did a month ago. I have adult acne almost literally overnight, and my face is so round and swollen. Like, I feel so puffy. And I went to doctor after doctor after doctor after doctor after doctor after doctor, and I was dismissed and dismissed and dismissed and dismissed and dismissed again and again and again and again. And I mean, you have to understand, for somebody who's been conditioned their whole life to disconnect from their own inner knowing, it's some miracle that I was like, no, this is wrong. But I don't know, man. I knew this wasn't right. And I'm a big, like, if it's broken, I'm going to fix it person. And I was broken and I was going to fix it. So I looked up all the best doctors I could. I found an allergist. I found an endocrinologist. I found a blah, 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 blah. I scheduled all these appointments in LA over the course of 2 or 3 days. And I was going to hit all these doctors one after the other. Boom, 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 boom. I plotted it all out on Google Maps. The drive time, how long the appointment would take. I filled out all these intakes in detail. I took a lot of time. And people were still like, yeah, you're fine. I did a full allergy prick test. No, you're not allergic to anything. It's not allergies, not this. So I was gathering data, which I can do. My brain can do that. Finally, I found somebody who changed my life. Dr. Lyle Kurtz changed my life. I walked into his office. He had clearly read my intake, which I don't think many doctors had. I used to carry around this binder, by the way, that was a 3-inch thick binder of my entire medical record from the day I was born, every immunization, everything that had ever been wrong with me, every image until I was the age that I was, like in my early 20s. I had everything in there. I compiled all my photos of my face to prove my acne and my moon face, like with dates under them. I made this binder and I would bring it into people and they would go, yeah. And they would dismiss me most of the time. And then I found Dr. Kurtz and I walked into his office. He had read my intake. And the second I walked in, he said, I know what's wrong with you. And I get emotional thinking about it because this is the first person and a long line after a long time of, pounding the pavement who, one, believed that anything was wrong with me, and two, had a solution for me, which was like mind-blowing to me. He took my photo for the charts and he said, I think you have polycystic ovarian syndrome, but we're going to run blood work and we're going to figure it out. He talked to me for over an hour, gave me a pie crust recipe, told me about, we shared about how he rode his stationary bike, and I was talking to him about working out, and, at this time I was already a trainer, and I just, in many ways, he saved my life. Like, not even because he just knew it was wrong, but because he was willing to listen to me. And I don't want anyone out there to ever doubt their capacity to touch another person's life, because even just listening to somebody in any capacity can truly, truly change their life. Like, it's, if nobody's listening and you have the ability to listen, it's profound. It creates profound impact. I should probably write him a letter. Anyways, so, he was a Western doctor. He put me on medication. I was put on spironolactone, which is a testosterone suppressant. I was put on birth control to regulate my hormones. He gave me, it's called a clinical diagnosis. You know, it's not one test. It's a bunch of little tests that they run, and they clinically decide through clinical rationale that, you know, this is what you have. So I was diagnosed with polycystic ovarian syndrome. Depending on who you ask, it's an autoimmune or not. The point is that the body will, you know, reflect. It will keep score. It will reflect these areas that have been neglected. And so, boy, oh boy, did it. I took those medications. They fixed my problems. I would read my pamphlet, you know, every time I got my medication that talked about liver tumors and how I'd have to be on this my whole life. And again, having kids was really important to me. And I was like, how the heck am I going to have kids if I'm on birth control? Like, then what? So your girl did what she always does. she said, this is not, you know, I decided this isn't addressing the root problem. I'm going to figure out the root problem and I'm going to address it naturally. And I gave myself a year, and a year turned into 10, and, you know, never went back. So along the way, I was diagnosed with hypothyroid. I had positive ANA markers, which is to show that I wasn't technically diagnosed with Hashimoto's. My sister has that, but I did have positive ANA markers and I had a slow thyroid. So, you know, I had some work cut out for me, but I've always liked having a little stack of work to do, or a big stack of work. So I got to work. I started with supplements. I researched the living daylights out of, oh man, if you name the supplement, I can tell you a lot about it. Chris Masterjohn, by the way, amazing resource. I started healing myself with supplements and food. You know, I went Socrates, you know, let food be thy medicine. And it worked. Imagine that. I also at this time had a practice of yoga. I think that that was very impactful. I leaned on it later in my 20s when I went through a breakup that was really hard for me. And it also saved my life. But, you know, the supplements, I was able to have a one-to-one metric for me, which made sense to me, right? If I have testosterone, I can take, or if I have high testosterone, I can take spearmint that will blunt it and bring it down. And it was so dang good at it that I brought my testosterone too low for a point there. But that would, you know, get rid of my acne or help my acne. And then, you know, I started learning about the liver and the detox pathways. I got many certifications along this way. You know, this has really shaped who I am as a clinician and who I am as a person. So I learned first supplements, then food. Then I found an integrative doctor, you know, to work with who would listen to me. Energy and energetics became really important. And I got every certification. I read every book that I could. I still am. I'm incredibly hungry for information on this topic. Or any topic I'm interested in. But, you know, I put my ANA markers in remission and my blood work showed no sign of PCOS. And I was always kind of afraid to do the thyroid one until recent years. And I've just noticed in living, you know, in this way that I've needed less and less thyroid medication. So I know what to do. So I believe I will start doing that. But I think that at this point, my body's just dependent on the synthetic hormone that I've been giving it, because that's how she works. So if I slowly lower that, which I've had to slowly lower it over time because my body's making it anyways, which it shouldn't be able to make it. So anyways, this just goes to show that, like, I really, you know, I one day at a time began to kind of connect to myself again. Yoga was that connection. And that, I think, is the foundation of this work. As crazy as it sounds, like, the supplementation allowed me it was a door in. You know, it gave me a one-to-one metric. After I had that one-to-one metric, you know, food was a little more gray. It wasn't one-to-one, but it was making sense to me. And then yoga, I didn't realize until later as my practice got stronger that, like, this connected me to my body and my breath, and that helped me connect to my nervous system. And knowing my nervous system was to know myself, and to know myself, I was also in therapy, sorry, for, like, all of this entire journey, which is also the foundation of this work. Like, I'm saying, like, the mind piece of this is what healed me. It's not, you know, the food or the nutrition. I think that that's actually secondary. And I think that getting to know myself again and metabolizing and first learning who I was and metabolizing how I came to be, like a lot of that story in the beginning, and coming to understandings of that and mourning losses of this idealized fantasy that I had as an infant that, you know, I wanted, or as a child that I wanted, that like was never, it was written in the stars, that wasn't for me. Like, this is what's for me. And I think that it's a learning that I'm incredibly grateful for. It gives me a grounding to stand on, you know, when I help other people, it gives me goosebumps. Like I know what it's like to be banging your head against the wall and doing everything right and not getting to your goal. And you think that it's you. And in some ways it's like you have the power to affect change, but it's like, it's not just you. It's like this constellation of like karmic history behind you that hasn't been resolved, that begins to add up to like these things that we're carrying. And I think as being, you know, being part of a family is to carry the karma of the family, and to carry the karma of the family, it's your choice to resolve the karma or not. And, you know, I don't know, I guess I could explain, I think we all basically know what karma is, but the Buddhists will say, you know, if you don't resolve it, the Dharma wheel comes in, like we'll throw you back in the bucket and you come back. And whether you believe that or not, I think it's an important piece just to know that like in your DNA, like epigenetics will show, you are your mother's daughter. Like you are your grandmother's granddaughter. Like there's things about our father, like there's things that we can be conditioned to having not yet been born yet that we will respond to in today's life. And to me, that's karma. And so to resolve your karma and to metabolize these things and really allow them to sit with you. And I say metabolize on purpose. I don't say get over. You don't get over these things. You metabolize them. You integrate them into your being. They get broken up into their respective parts and organized, you know, respectively. And that's who you are. You don't get over it and never look back. You get into it and become it. In the best way, because it becomes diluted, but it's still in you. It's still a part of you. And to know that part of you is, I think it's so important. And for those of you with autoimmune or other, you know, body assemble issues, or if your body is keeping the score, whether you get cancer, you know, we have diabetes or, you know, chronic pain, or there's direct links between trauma and chronic pain, period. There just are. So, you know, you can say like, oh, it releases all these inflammatory markers. Yeah, that's going to cause a problem. How many times have you heard, you know, the root of all disease is like chronic inflammation? Well, what creates chronic inflammation? It's not just the food we're eating. It's not just the food supply. It's not just all the toxins around. It is your stress response and your mind. It is you. And you know, I'm an introvert, so I'm very biased. And by introvert, you know, if you haven't listened to the introversion extroversion episode, go listen to it. You'll understand what I mean by then. But an introvert doesn't mean that you're like always kept to yourself. Your world exists inside of you. Everybody has an internal and external world, but introverts have this really rich internal world, and this is where they go to recharge. And people can be mapped to this internal world, but the internal world as an introvert is really important because to me, this is my world. This is my playground. I would rather be there than anywhere else because anything is possible. Anything can happen and I get to control it all, quite frankly. But what I believe in there and why it's relevant is that like this is kind of where the healing happens. It's like if I start to tell a story, good or bad, I'm going to believe it eventually. And so I start to tell a good story. You are capable of healing. You can do this. And then the data starts to pile up on the external world that shows you the physical, tangible proof of that. And it begins to compound. And then it's like compound interest. And before it, you're a metaphorical millionaire. And you know, your life is like exploding with good things, and you're healed and you feel good, and you did it. Like nobody did it for you, and that creates esteem for yourself. And self-esteem is often misconstrued as like thinking highly of yourself. No, esteem for yourself is a history of looking back and saying, I effing did that and I can do it. No matter how big, no matter how small, you put little things in a bucket that equate to esteem for yourself and whether or not you did something. And I think for a really long time in my life, I thought I had a high sense of self or self-esteem because I liked myself. I really did. I thought I was pretty cool. Like I had, my mom would always tell me like when I was growing up, like, oh, you're great. You're this, you're that. So that's where it was coming from. It wasn't me that really believed that. And since I was so disconnected from my sense of self, I just, you know, it was like this falsehood. Like, I don't know if you can kind of see this thread of me listening to outside experiences before I understand my internal experience. This goes back to my personality type. This is how I'm kind of primed. This is my journey. This is my karma. This is how I will be the rest of my life. You know, I'm going to learn that way. Some people learn intrinsically first and then they go extrinsically. But you know, I'm an out-in person as much as I'm an in-out person. Anyway, yeah, I think that's the end of my story. I think that's the end of my babbling. But you know, that's how I got into this work. That's who I am. It's why I'm really deeply passionate about helping other people pilot through it. There's a big piece about being a high achiever. I think when you're a high achiever, the world rewards you really well. But, and it's kind of a catch-22 because to look at your hard places in your life as a hard achiever, high achiever, is almost to admit that you're not high achieving in a weird way. Like, it's like, you don't want to allow that in. It goes against the grain. So you almost have to be, I want to say tricked. I suppose it's a manipulation, not in the negative connotation. I suppose it could be, but it's a manipulation. You know, you have to kind of bend the perspective so they can see, myself included, what they need to see. And so I have a really soft spot for high achieving, want to make other people happy, you know, really strong people. I really do, because it's, you know, quite frankly, it's sort of selfish. It's because it's me, you know, it's like, oh, I know this beast well, like, let me help you get out from under the thumb of always needing to do and work and be and like living life like that makes you sick. I was lucky that, you know, I'm pedal to the metal. So I found out when I was young and I was able to solve it rather young because I'm a high achieving, high performing person because I was conditioned when I was a child. And it was part of what gave me an autoimmune disorder or two, right? But I feel really lucky. I really do. I feel really lucky. I'm sort of in awe sometimes that I was given the tools and I had the courage to pick them up. And if I didn't have the tool, I had the resourcefulness to go make, create, or find it. And I think that that's my belief for other people. Like, I believe that everybody has this ability to resource. Doesn't mean that you have everything you need, but you have the ability to make it or find it or, you know, outsource it. Like, you, the resourcefulness is the important piece. I believe this. I think it's why it goes to, like, why I love, you know, leadership and teams and people. I think there's a lot of overlap there. But alas, I digress. That's my story. That's me. If you like it, follow along. I'm here. I'm here for it. My hope is that you can, you know, love yourself a little more, accept yourself a little more, listen to yourself a little, if not a lot more, so you can do the things you love and you can, you know, find joy in life, fulfillment in life. It's not always easy, but boy, is it worth it. Thank you for listening. If you've made it to the end, I so appreciate you. I guess we'll see you on the next one, or we'll hear you on the next one, won't we? All right. See you later, guys. Well, folks, that's the end. Thank you for joining me today, and I cannot thank you enough for being part of my community. If you'd like to join us on the Instagrams, you can find us at mindfulmove.co. Our website is www.mindfulmove.co. Thank you so much for being part of my life, taking time to listen, and being part of this community. I love you all so much, Have a beautiful and blessed today with Love and Light, signing out.